It is 7:31, and we are very lucky to have with us live in the studios this morning, Dennis Kine. Dennis is a Desert Storm veteran. He's got 15 years experience in the Army, and we're going to be talking about some of his experiences with that. Dennis, thanks for coming in this morning.
Thank you for having me. Good to be here. Well, great to be in Seattle. It's my first time up this way. So, hello, everybody.
All right. Well, welcome to Seattle. Let's begin with tell us how you got into the Army.
I come from a background that we could say was economically disadvantaged, if you will. I grew up in a two-bedroom apartment with my father, and there wasn't a lot of money, so I fell for the Army College Fund and job training. I enlisted when I was 17 years old. But in addition to that, I come from an extensive family background where we have a lot of retired full colonels and a lot of people who served in every conflict all the way back to the Civil War. So, I was basically like John Knowles talks about in A Separate Piece, and I was born onto active duty. I really had a very disciplined whole upbringing. But when it came time to think about, getting out of high school, going to college, I didn't have a lot of options. And so the one I chose was the one that they said would give me $23,000 to go to college with. And I signed up on the line for that and to be trained as a medic. And I had a dream of one day becoming a doctor. So I said, this is what I'll do. I'll get some college money, get started in, understanding the way the lymph glands work. And off I went. That was when I was 18, I went down to Fort Sam Houston, became a medical specialist. And then after that, went to Fort Benning, Georgia, went to airborne school, became a parachutist on Fort Benning. And that was the beginning of my career. I stayed on Fort Benning from the time I was 18 till I was about 21 years old. I served as a medic for airborne school, for the 4th Ranger Training Brigade as a medic with them. I served at the School of Americas as a medic there. I served with the infantry, the 197th, helped them. And then I was sent to Nuclear Biological Chemical School on Fort Benning, Georgia, which is where I learned what nuclear fallout is and radioactive fallout and electromagnetic pulses and all that rhetoric they use to describe what a nuclear war is. And Christmas of 89, I watched some guys commit suicide who came home from Panama, and then 8 months later we were shipped to Operation Desert Shield, which was the beginning of that particular conflict. It was Operation Desert Shield. A lot of people don't remember that. That 500,000 of us were sent over there to defend Saudi Arabia from an invasion by Iraq. We weren't sent there to even fire off a round. We were sent there to protect them from an invasion of Iraq into Saudi Arabia. We weren't sent there to storm anybody. And that hijacking didn't come till about November when they had disguised, their bombing raids and things like that. We started talking about removing, people from Kuwait. That was when it went from Desert Shield into this idea of Operation Desert Storm, and we would go on the attack. So basically we were duped into getting over there on a defensive posture, which is all Norman Schwarzkopf ever was a defensive commander. He never planned a battle plan to go on the offensive. So we were totally ignorant to what it was going to take to actually go on the offensive when we got there. And all Norman knew was to call for 500,000 troops and get them up there while they bombed depleted uranium all over the southern tip of Iraq and Kuwait. So the 500,000 troops that Norman called up all walked into that stuff. And I think, the main point I'm trying to make here is that, this particular administration, whether it be, the father or the son or the guy before the father, they don't actually declare war anymore. We have a War Powers Act that says, we have to declare war by Congress. So they call everything an operation, Operation Iraqi Freedom. This mainstream media, this fourth check on government, is the one who keeps calling it a war. But up there in Congress, they don't call it a war. They call it an operation, just like Operation Just Cause in Panama, Operation Desert Shield, Operation Desert Storm. And we've been bombing Iraq for 15 years now, Operation Desert Fox. We sent a bunch of Marines over there, just, I'm not sure, 98 or somewhere in that area, but Operation Desert Fox. We've been over there fighting. This is going on as long as Vietnam now. It's the same war. We've been involved in it for over a decade now. And it's still Operation Desert Shield, if you will. That's where it all began.
I want to get back to your experience in Operation Desert Storm, but before that, you mentioned that in Panama that you'd and suicides.
Okay, right. Well, you have the 3rd Ranger Battalion shipped. The Ranger Battalions all work. One of them's ready, one of them's on leave, and one of them's the next one ready to go. So when Panama happened, it happened during a period when the 3rd Ranger Battalion was on the ready up. And it was Christmas, and they were the only battalion on ready up. The other battalions were at home celebrating Christmas. So they got shipped down there, but Georgia is, Fort Benning, Georgia is also, you know, it's one of the most southern, you know, groups of Rangers. So they went down to Panama, and there's a, just huge accounts of friendly fire, these soldiers coming out of the bushes. And the account I always refer to the most of is the one where they're supposed to put magic tape on their uniform so that if they're coming out of the bush at nighttime, a helicopter will be able to recognize them as a friend or a foe, whether their magic tape is on, because it has a type of a glow to it. Well, the platoon leader, you know, forgot to tell the troops to put their magic tape on, so when they came out of the bush, the helicopter gunned them down. And then when the soldiers came home, they were distraught. You know, there wasn't too many survivors of this particular group here that I'm referring to. And, you know, three or four of these guys committed suicide. And they're called, they're referred to as the barracks incidents. And if you talk to any Rangers who were around there in 89, they know what I'm talking about when I say the barracks incidents. And so they're referred to as the barracks incidences. And what they did after these soldiers committed suicide was they told their parents that they had died by a weapons cleaning accident in their room. They were in their room cleaning their weapon, and a round went off and killed them. And that's how they released that to their parents. And, you know, being 19, 20 years old, I was shocked. And that was like my first wake-up call. You know, School of Americas didn't even wake me up as much as that event woke me up, you know. And I realized that, you know, they're prepared to just totally disguise the truth.
I know the suicide rate is very high. A lot of people listening probably wouldn't be aware of how high in the military the suicide rate is and how much effort is put into covering that up.
Mm-hmm.
Just, for instance, I was surprised to hear when we were talking before we went live, you were talking about how many people had committed suicide from the Vietnam War. Right. And I had put the number at 50,000. Which I thought was pretty high, and you said it was actually twice that.
Right. I like to say that, you know, two out of the three deaths that have been a result of Vietnam are, you know, let's just call it killing themselves, you know. I mean, some of them took the long way, and some of them took the short way. Some of them put a bullet in their head, and some of them ate pills, and some of them either slammed heroin or just drank until they, you know, were either dead or shot in some lunatic fringe. So the accounts put you at about 2 to 3, you know, twice as many people have died post-Vietnam due to, you know, suicide, addictions, than you know, actually died in combat of the 58,000 they've accounted for. And I know from personal experience at the front end of Operation Desert Shield, they shipped us over there. We were the first medical unit to get there. So we had to spend 90 days in what they referred to as Cement City. And the war hadn't even started, and soldiers were already killing themselves. I mean, that hopelessness and the despair, they kept us festering in this, you know, a concentration camp, literally, for 90 days. And, yeah, soldiers committed suicide there. Soldiers have committed suicide since, you know, Desert Storm. There's roughly 15, 20,000, probably even a higher number if we count incarcerated in the brig and things like that from rape or violent crime. I mean, they're telling all these people that they're heroes, right? We won the most incredible victory, military victory ever in the history of the world. They're heroes, and we have this many people incarcerated for rape or violent crime. That's not very heroic, you know. So the result of this is just total mental neurosis. And it happens even more specifically in the Army. The Army is far more susceptible to these rapes and violent crimes. Not just because of the sheer numbers, there's way more Army people than there are any other branch, but because of the indoctrination that occurs in there. It's a very gradual indoctrination that pretty much teaches you that by the end, what you know and what you really think you should be doing at any given moment is behaving like Timothy McVeigh or John Allen Muhammad, who are both very decorated Desert Storm veterans.
Well, you leave me at a tough juncture here. Where do we go from
Well,
here?
I did that on purpose. Because a lot of people don't know that. That's why I did that. A lot of people don't recognize that Timothy McVeigh was a frontline tanker who, in Operation Desert Storm, 75% on an MIT study say that friendly fire caused 75% of the deaths in Desert Storm. That's MIT research. And what was happening was these lieutenant colonels and full colonels were going up in the air into these sandstorms, and the sand was covering up their helicopter. They would be flying around in sandstorms with no McDonald's to refer to as a point of reference, so they get totally lost up in the air. All of a sudden, they just start picking their own tanks off. And they're picking their tanks off with depleted uranium, which later on, they started studying these soldiers with embedded depleted uranium fragments in them, like Joseph Mengele or something. So when we recognized that all these friendly fire casualties occurred, Timothy McVeigh was on the front line. He came home. He's all, look, will somebody please talk about this? Somebody please tell me that all these guys didn't really die in that much of a crime. You know, we didn't even really engage in that many tank battles, but we lost all these troops. And nobody wanted to talk about it, you know. And John Allen Muhammad, who knows? I don't condone any of the behavior. I don't think that the response is any way justified, but you're dealing with people who maybe haven't developed the intellectual skills to deal with their emotions yet, and they've been indoctrinated since they were 18 into a behavior that says kill, kill, kill. You know, what makes the green grass grow, drill sergeant? Blood, blood, blood. You know, things like that. And you do that long enough and repetitively enough, and sooner or later, that's what you know. And when you go to reach for your recourse, that's what you grab. You know, those are your resources. Kill, kill, kill. And then that's how they behave, because they don't know what else to do.
Right, and the outlets that would be available to, let's say, civilians, where you would go see a psychiatrist, where you would talk about this to other people, in the Army's case, and I know in those, we were saying in the Rangers' case down in Panama, they were told, do not talk about this.
They were ordered not to. You get a debriefing anytime you end up in a hot area like that on your way back into the country, if you will. You get debriefed, and you get told that, you know, if you talk, you'll get court-martialed. And that's the easiest way to shut up any soldier. You tell him he's going to get court-martialed, and he has the fear of Fort Leavenworth and slamming bricks for the rest of his life. And he's been getting that since the day he started basic training. So he's indoctrinated into this, you know, this vertical chain of command that says, well, you know, just one rank above him, whether it's a specialist telling a private first class, he's got to listen to him and not talk to anybody. You don't even know where the orders are coming from after a while. You just start behaving, you know, in response to these secrecies. Like all of a sudden you're just a little private who knows something's wrong, but you're sworn to secrecy. And it just is too much shame there for you not to be suicidal.
So talk about some of your own experiences. You eventually ended up, after being in Cement City, you actually ended up in the front lines in Desert Storm. Can you talk about that?
Right, right. Yeah, I always like to address that, and I'll just go on all the way to the front line. You know, we were shipped out of Fort Benning, Georgia. They vaccinated us with some of the most incredible vaccinations ever. You know, these anthrax vaccinations that were loaded with squalene, which is an adjutant to speed up the process. It's totally illegal. They were just testing it out on us. So everybody was, you know, barfing and everything all the way to the Middle East. Then we got to Cement City, which left us festering in a totally contaminated area. And we were getting fed food that was grown in night soil, which is high nitrogen soil, which is growing food in fecal matter, literally. And we were eating that. We thought our food was contaminated. We didn't know what was going on. And then we got out there and we started ingesting a lot of sand because of the sandstorms, which just leads to dysentery. So everybody's got mass exodus of the fluids by way of number two. All of a sudden you got heat casualties all around you. And poisonous rodents everywhere, because out in the middle of the desert, nothing lives that isn't poisonous generally. So the kids are getting bitten all the time, so they bring in pesticides to kill all the rodents. And, you know, Major Doug Rocky, for those who know him, he likes to say that these pesticides were also purchased off the black market. You know, the Department of Defense ran out of them, and then they went on the black market and bought them. So the soldiers ingested incredible amounts of pesticides while there. Then they loaded us up with peristig bromide tablets, which was intended to shut down our synapses in case we ingested a biological or a nerve agent or a chemical agent, and that it wouldn't rip through our nerves. It would be blocked off at the synapses. And I was just alarmed at what I was hearing, but it sounded like math, and so everybody started eating them. I ate them for 3 days, started projectile vomiting. So I quit eating them. I know I'm a medic, and if my body's rejecting it, then I'd rather just take my chances. This is before the war even started. This is long before January. We're in Christmas time right now, and everybody's just falling over like flies, and their immune system is trashed. And then we walked into depleted uranium, because on January 17th, when the ground war started, we started bombing them all day and all night for 45 days with what was confirmed to be 300 to 350 tons of depleted uranium. And the soldiers walked right into it. And that's why the ground war only lasted 72 hours. 3 days. That's why it was such a short victory, because we couldn't advance any further. There was nowhere for us to get to. And the reason this happened to us was because of the ignorance of, you know, our military, and the ignorance of these young lieutenants who come out of college thinking they know everything but literally know nothing, is that we were going into a sand agricultural system, which is far different than a soil-based agricultural system or something of that nature. And we never heard of wadis, which W-A-D-I in the Webster's Dictionary will tell you a wadi is a free-flowing river in Arabia. And when we used to watch Lawrence of Arabia, we'd see him land down in the quicksand. Well, what that was a wadi. And so my vehicle got stuck in wadis. We had to pull vehicles out of wadis, and we couldn't get to Baghdad from the northern tip of Saudi Arabia without driving through, and we couldn't get through them. So then we had to hang a right turn. Later on in the news, they reported it as the end run or the left hook. We couldn't get through the wadi, so we went for the highway because there's only one highway into Baghdad, which is where a lot of people ran into the highway of death, which they had just incinerated with depleted uranium rounds. So in 72 hours, we realized very quickly that we couldn't get to Baghdad. We ran into depleted uranium, and it was time to go home. Ceasefire, no way. There was never the airfield they were supposedly had the ceasefire on, I was at, and that nobody showed up that day. So, you know, the reason we went home after 72 hours was because everybody was sick, and they flew us home on TWA. We flew home with stewardesses and everything, and we didn't go home on C-130s or C-141s. They wanted to get us home quick. And the idea there is because if you die, you better die on American soil, then you're not a combat casualty.
And so you're seeing, you're at the front, and you're seeing all these people getting really, really sick.
Right.
And did you know at the time that that was because of the depleted uranium?
Well, I don't like to just stretch too far, but when you feed people pyrrhistic bromide, bromide is nasty. Doug Rocky will tell you that it's like eating Black Flag or Raid. And if you do that to them, and you know this isn't like, why are you dumbing people up and then walking them into depleted uranium? So that when they come, we have so many accounts of brain damage even before respiratory problems, because this pyrrhistic bromide just ate people up and their synapses never reopened. You know, so, you know, they dumbed them up and walked them into this thing. And, you know, you take a look at what that could really mean. You know, like we were talking about a little bit earlier, all the nuclear testing we've been willing to do over the last 60 years. Who knows if this wasn't just a test? I have no idea. I know that the ground engagement was very limited. You know, the Marines went down to Kafji and got whooped by the Iraqis. The Iraqis who'd fought in the Iran-Iraq conflict for 7 years and were hardened veterans. They whooped the Marines. So we knew we weren't prepared to do urban warfare either. And that's why for the last 10 years we've been training to go back. We've been training for the last 10 years to occupy cities, literally. When I came home from the conflict, Operation Desert Storm, everybody was sick, so I went to drill sergeant school. And I was a drill sergeant on Fort Sill, Oklahoma, Fort Bliss, Texas, which is where I really started to realize that we were training people to go back there and occupy these cities. And that's essentially what we've been doing. That's why it's taken 15 years. A lot of people don't realize we've been doing this for a decade and a half now.
Yeah. So when you started seeing people going down and stuff, then you guys, after 3 days, were pulled back and another group was sent in?
Right. We not just pulled back. We beat feet all the way back to Dahal Ran, which was where we had entered into port. That's all the way where everything began. We were back there, and we were back there real quick. We convoyed. We slept underneath our vehicles at night to get there. We didn't camp. We just drove all the way back. And the team they sent to clean up literally belongs, if you will, for our record, Major Rocky. They sent him forward and up there to say, okay, what's happening? And these are the soldiers that generally got much sicker than the guys I served with. And the reason they did was because they worked in this area for months on end, cleaning up the mess that had been left there so the mainstream media would never be able to take pictures of it. They had to get that cleaned up before anybody from, you know, Wall Street Journal showed up or something. So they went in there and they put them in full protective gear, what's called MOP Level 5. MOPP stands for Military Occupational Protective Posture. And Level 5 means you have everything, your mask, gloves, booties, and you're really dressed up. And you're trained in NBC school, Nuclear Biological Chemical School. You're trained in basic training to believe that you're invincible when you're in this suit. Like, they have you believing that you're never any safer than when you're in this suit. So the kids walked around in this stuff thinking they were safe. But in this particular group, where you notice the impacts is in their children, because they've ingested these what they call alpha-emitting dust particles, which lodge in your kidneys and your lungs and things like that. So their sicknesses, you know, they're the brunt of the sickness of the people who actually weren't even there during the bombing runs or the ground war.
And that's because the DU particles are so small that they manage to get through the filtering systems?
Absolutely. In the Stanford Journal, 1961, scientific, it's more like a study guide here, but they did the research. They found a metallurgical particle, once cooked off and burned in extreme heat, actually reduces itself to be smaller than a bacteria or a virus. So it means you can't find it with a microscope. And so these are submicron particles, and the protective masks that we use in the military aren't submicron. They're only like gas and, you know, like don't worry if the police come shoot you with their little gas bomb, but submicron metallurgical particles, well, they can get through there. Now, you double the impact when it's a radioactive particle. You know, it's not just like lead, heavy metal poisoning. It's also radioactive, which means it's beating and emitting for 4.5 billion years, which is the half-life, which makes it 45 billion years, which means it's longer than our experience. And so, yeah, these particles, they get everywhere. And it just takes a little particle just start decaying the whole internal organs.
So part of what these guys did was clean off the vehicles on the Highway of Death?
Well, that might be what they did after the Bikini Island testing when they brought it all back into the port of San Francisco and cleaned it off. No, they did it different this time. They dug out trenches on the side of the road and buried everything. And the reason they did that was because they didn't. The real objective was to hide it from the mainstream media. You know, these weapons didn't leave any craters. They didn't leave any holes in the ground. So once you buried everything, the highway was drivable again. You know, there might be a couple tanks that the kids went and played around on. But yeah, there wasn't an actual cleaning process. It was a burial process, you know. The cleaning process of our vehicles, if you will, which had to happen because we couldn't just leave everything we took over there. We would drive them all the way back to Dhahran, where they were in a decon site, which is where Major Rocky actually started, was back there with the vehicles in the decon tent. My stepbrother was back there as a security patrol officer. And these vehicles went in there, and they were emitting back there Geiger counters. They had them covered in plastic and everything. So on the back, we took our vehicles, drove them all the way back through Saudi Arabia, kicking particles everywhere, took them in there, and a lot of the Air Force guys, who weren't even all the way up front, are sick. That's why you have a lot of Air Force officers involved in the depleted uranium investigation. But up front, there was never any intention of cleaning, only hiding. And they knew they had to because, none of the pilots could see what they had done down there. And so they sent a whole nother crew of people up there to bury it, if you will. I say clean up, but it wasn't. It was just a disguise.
Yeah, I think Helen Caldicott says there's no way you can ever clean something like this up. You have a website, denniskyne.com, DENNISKYNE. And on your website, you have photos, some of which you've taken, which I encourage people to go to that website and look at that. Can we talk about those for a couple minutes?
Absolutely.
Tell me about why you took those photos in the first place and describe what they are.
Well, The photos, you know, some of them are taken by me, some of them are taken by soldiers from the 24th Infantry Division, which is a confirmed contaminated unit that General McCaffrey was the general of, who later became the drug czar of America. He was the most criminal general in that conflict. The 24th Infantry Division was still killing people after the so-called ceasefire. The pictures generally were taken by people in the medical, a med department, a medic, or somebody in the veterinarian command, because medics are supposed to document the battlefield and what it will do to the health of the troops. And so since soldiers were becoming instantly sick, we knew that there was something amiss. Like, there was no question about it. So soldiers, you know, that's why there's great pictures from the Highway of Death, which we never actually moved on. My pictures are an isolated incident, like a drive-by shooting, if you will. An A-10 went by and obviously pelted a truck that was driving down the road. The Highway of Death was much more deadly to the American troops, you know. But the pictures were taken, and we didn't know what we were looking at. We had no idea what was going on. We had no idea what we were looking at. And so they were taken to document this event, even though we were ordered not to have any cameras in that country. And it was illegal for us to take pictures. It would be court-martialed if we were pictures, but we had a veterinarian commander who said, no, I got these orders, and they say take pictures.
So, and to describe the pictures for the listeners, it would be common to see a truck and some bodies next to it.
Mm-hmm.
The unique thing about the whole incident is the bodies are of what appears to be dead Iraqi soldiers, clearly dead.
Right.
The uniforms are totally intact, yet the skin and anything that was flesh-based is totally gone.
Right.
As well as, like, the tires on the trucks, if you look at them next to it, are still intact. So whatever, and there's no craters visible in any of the pictures. So whatever killed these people clearly wasn't a flame-based attack, because that would have lit the uniforms on fire and or melted the tires. So one would go to the conclusion then that perhaps it was a nuclear-type device.
Right. Shock and awe, if you will. And you can have a look at it. You know, I mean, I'll explain it, and then you can go on the TV screen and look at what was going on over Qusar during this past conflict. And there was a mushroom cloud over Qusar. Andrews was on it on CNN. He said, that mushroom cloud's, or he didn't call it a mushroom cloud. He goes, this cloud has been over Qusar for 6 or 7 days, and we're not quite sure what this is. Well, Andrews, that's what we call a mushroom cloud. And they like to call it shock and awe. But shock and awe leaves these little mini mushrooms, and we saw them all over Baghdad, this war. They were just pelting low-level nuclear weapons. And that's exactly what these pictures depict. And the way they depict it is a low-level. The only difference between low-level and high-level is the blast area, literally. You know, they recognize that they just needed a little less uranium to do the same job. You know, they didn't need to put truckloads of it like they did in Hiroshima and Nagasaki to create carnage. The intention, as former U.S. Attorney General Ramsey Clark likes to say, the intention of nuclear weapons is to kill everything living, whether it be vegetative, animal, or people, and keep the property intact. Somebody else can move in and use it. And the picture is really, if you look at them, you know, it isn't death. I mean, I've shown these pictures for a decade. 12 years I've shown them to people, and they just look at it like it's death. I don't know, somebody dead. But if you take a look and you take a step back at the causal relationship between their death and these people have been melted. You know, you're right, they're not burned. There's no ashes. The bodies are carbonized. You can see the shadows in the pavement, just like they did in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And, you know, it took me a long time to make that deduction because we don't have any point of reference, really. I talk to people now, they look at these mini mushrooms all over Iraq, this conflict, and I explain to them, they go, oh, no, that's not possible. And it's a very simple analysis. Over Dresden and Hamburg, there was craters everywhere during that war. Just that's what a conventional weapon does. It leaves a crater. There's no craters. There's mushroom clouds, though. That means we're using non-conventional weapons. There's not even need to have anybody to verify it or prove it. You could look at it and see that that's what they left. And it has and the reason the Geneva Convention and the reason the European Union and the reason that the World Conference on Uranium Weapons have said that, you know, this is a crime against humanity and a war crime is because it leaves something in that battlefield long after the battle's over. And that is what makes it a war crime. You're not supposed to be leaving things around that kill innocent civilians and people who just don't even know there might have ever even been a battle there in the first place. And we're leaving carnage and wreckage from our nuclear reactors, which is where this is a byproduct of. You know, this uranium-238 is a byproduct of our nuclear development, and we're just hurling it over there and using it as a disposal site right now.
Got about a minute left. What final thoughts would you like to leave the listeners with?
Oh, I support Jim McDermott, man. Cheer for him, yell for him. He's one of the only people on the floor who is actually addressing the issue of depleted uranium. You know, he's put bills in there, and just now I'm up in Seattle. I just want to say thanks, you know, Mr. McDermott, man. The soldiers are starving for somebody to help them. They need somebody to help them. I'm trying to do the best I can, you know, but we need some people to really embrace and help these veterans and soldiers who don't want to fight in this conflict. They've been mentally hijacked, and really this issue could put us at the forefront, depleted uranium, because there's going to be a truckload of soldiers coming home sick again, and there already are. And so thanks for having me, and I'm thanking Seattle because it's really an instrumental piece. I'm glad to be here because we're addressing depleted uranium up here, and I appreciate it.
All right. Well, I'd like to get you back on the show sometime, so Okay. Maybe we can do that.
Right.
Okay, we have just been talking with Dennis Kine. He is a Desert Storm veteran and 15 years experience in the Army, and you can check out his website, again, at www.denniskyne.com.